Welcome to Investor Resources with your hosts, Don Creech and Perry Sykes, who both realize that the market doesn't know what keeps you up at night. It doesn't know when you want to retire, and it doesn't know how old you are. The simple truth is, the market doesn't care. But if you care, then you've tuned in at the perfect time. You're listening to Investor Resources, bringing clarity to the confusing world of finance. Here are your hosts of Investor Resources, Don Creech and Perry Sykes.
Well, good morning. This is Don Creech.
And this is Perry Sykes. Welcome to the show, everyone.
So it's just a couple minutes after 8 o'clock, assuming that your alarm has gone off and it's a radio clock. You're listening to us. How about that?
Bingo.
Glad to have you in the audience out there. So, sleepy eyelids are kind of wake open, break open, and see the bright sunlight. It's going to be a bright, sunshiny day. Should have used that for bump music today.
But would have been appropriate, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, if you have questions about your portfolio, the dynamics of stock market swings, or some recommendation that your friendly local financial advisor has suggested you do, and you're wondering, is this for me or is this for you? Well, now's the time to pick up the phone. Give us a call at 888-312-5757, 888-312-5757, and we will be glad to chat with you. It is your weekend opportunity to ask questions and get another opinion on what might be on the top of your mind. Just pick up your phone and call. It has been a challenging year. I start to say exciting, but not all of it was. So over the last 12 months, we have had a zero interest rate policy. Of course, we've been collecting zero interest rates from any money left in the bank for some time. The Fed has printed, or they don't really print, they kind of create out of thin air, more than $3 trillion. We just call it money printing to try to explain what's going on. And the Fed has been buying left and right corporate bonds, muni bonds, corporate bond, exchange-traded funds, treasuries, mortgage-backed securities, student loans, certificates of deposit, anything else they could find to make it appear that everything is fine on the home front. Fear not, Jay Powell has it under control. Until just recently, when the Fed finally announced that it is thinking about tightening monetary policy. Well, it only took the CPI clearing 5%, multiple signals of inflation running hot, real estate in what does appear to be a bubble. Oh, that B word, that is so hard for the Fed to come to deal with. Stocks hitting new all-time highs. Little frothiness in the market when somebody actually was able to sell a non-fungible token, which means it's just a digital creation of some software programming, a token of their fart. And I think it was $17,000. I mean, who on earth? Now, this, of course, is not speculation in the market. My goodness. Cryptocurrencies, including ones that were designed as jokes, hitting new highs. I mean, if this isn't the sign of idiots, maniacs, and complexities of risk, what on earth do we need to look for?
Everybody's hoping for the greater fool. You need the greater fool to come along later and buy it from you once you have it.
So risk management is actually a fairly complicated topic. I mean, we go through an end-of-week risk analysis of the market. Do these things make sense? Is this particular indicator risk on or risk off? What about this one or that one? Well, actually, I have a list of several lists that we go in and look for some more intermediate-term risk on, risk off, and some shorter-term risk on, risk off, to identify what may be about to change. When things feel safe, we typically let our guard down. I mean, that's human reality. It's the way the mind works. And we see this in all sorts of different real life situations have nothing to do with the market. They have to do with our life.
Which is important because that's we're all part of the market. That's part of the equation that so many people miss, that the way human beings behave has a lot to do with what goes on in any market, stock market, bond market, any commodities market, anything where people are involved to a large extent in getting to make decisions, then the human behavior becomes a big factor in how that works out.
So, for example, let's take driving. Last year, there were an awful lot of people staying home. The roads were less traveled. However, traffic deaths increased by 7% over the year before. They were at a 13-year high on roads that were less congested.
How about that?
That seems to be a disconnect. So how does that happen? Well, there's fewer cars on the road. I can drive faster. And that's exactly what happened. People quit wearing their seatbelts. Even the people who were a little under the influence, or, well, actually maybe a lot under the influence, decided, there's nobody out there. It's okay for me to drive. People became less cautious in an environment that looked like it was safer. And you don't have to be an average driver to reach that issue. You can be somebody who has some really highly tested skills, like the pilots that were test flying rockets prior to our launching to the moon. I mean, you would think that these are test rockets that have wings on them, that their death rate would be fairly high, because that's a pretty high-risk job.
Got to be a dangerous job, right? Absolutely.
But back in the era when we were doing that, this is the stuff leading up to the landing on the moon in the 60s, these early rocket prototypes tested by Navy pilots, this is new, unproven technology, highly dangerous, yet more Navy pilots died in car crashes than in air crashes. Mm-hmm. Because, what was the movie that Tom, what's his name, was in? That they were hotshot pilots. I know, it slips my mind. And anyway, once they're in the air, they're flying this massive, highly expensive, highly technological machine. They're really careful.
they have their full attention focused on not crashing. Apparently not the case when they're all driving their cars around.
Yeah, they get back down to the ground and say, well, that was a fun ride. And as every pilot knows, any landing that you walk away from is considered a good landing. But you get in the car to drive home, and the sense of impermeability and immortality seems to disappear. It doesn't disappear. They still think they are. So we end up with risky behavior that just simply doesn't always make sense. And that happens in the stock market. I mean, people see something going up, but they're afraid to get in because they've lost money before. They're just not sure they know what they're doing. And so they're cautious until that stupid brother-in-law, he keeps bragging about how much money he's making in the market, and you are sitting in the bank.
And we constantly try to explain that to people when they're, especially new clients when they come in, and because we don't use a risk return questionnaire like most firms. We don't have anybody fill out a risk return questionnaire. Let's determine how much risk you should take, because people's risk level changes all the time. It's constantly changing depending on what's going on in the market. If everything's going up, they want to be in. Everything should be on the table. We should be making money here. If things are all trending down, well, no, we should be very, very conservative now. We should go to only safe assets, and we need to be very safe right now. So just like the market changes all the time, a person's perception of the risk in the market changes all the time also. So that static risk return questionnaire is just as useless as that static pie chart we're always talking about. They don't do any good on the long term.
Well, and the change from risk averse to risk taking occurs at market tops, and aggressive to, boy, I shouldn't have done that. We really should be more conservative after we've lost a lot of money and it's a market bottom. The human emotions are just the opposite of what opportunity is in the market. And everybody knows you're supposed to buy low and sell high, but few have a discipline to sell high in order to have cash at market lows. And they both go hand in hand. But most investors and most investment policies miss that part of the equation. One of the ways you can get a better handle on that would be to register for next week's stock market update. Go to IRIRadio.com. IRI.
It's the week after, Don. It's the 10th.
Oh, that's right.
July 10th, right.
Well, the first Saturday is supposed to be the one we do it.
There you go.
But because of the holiday, you're right. It's 2 weeks out. So Perry just saved you, bought you some more time. Register for that. But get registered now, even if you can't attend then. You will get a replay link. If you want to talk to us this morning, it's not too late to do that. 888-312-5757. One of the things that everybody wants to know is, what's the market doing tomorrow?
That'd be a good thing to know, yes. That'd be very handy.
Let's do that after. Let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll talk about forecasting the market
forecasting.
When we come back.
That's a big subject. We'll get to that when we come back. I'd like to remind everyone once again that on July 10th, we're going to have our next market update, 9:15, right after the show. You can register for that by going to IRIRadio.com. That is IRIRadio.com. Just go to the webinar page and give the registration link a click. You'll get an email back, and on the 10th, you just click that after the show. You'll be online with live online with us. You'll be able to see our charts, see what we're talking about, taking a look at what's going on out there in the market. And we always have plenty of time to get to all of your questions. So it's a really great time if you have questions about the market, the economy, or even individual securities that you either are holding on to and are wondering if that's still a good idea or something you're thinking about buying. It's a great time to get a second opinion on that, and we'll do that live online. Again, you can register for that at IRIRadio.com. This morning, if you want to talk to us, give us a call, 888-312-5757. That's 888-312-5757. We will be right back. Stay with us.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again.
Well, I guess I did put that in there. Let us sing a song of cheer as the indices hit new highs. So we got a couple of stocks that get a lot of money flowing into them, and the stock market looks like it's really healthy, while most of the market is improving, but is many of the sectors of the market are still struggling. And we mentioned before going to this last break that we would talk about forecasting. Forecasting takes up massive amounts of time on radio and TV business news. What's the big deal? Trying to figure out what the Fed is doing? I mean, my goodness, look what the Fed's been doing for years, telling us, one, there's no inflation, we're waiting for it to get above 2%, and then we might start raising rates, but it just stays, way too low to justify higher rates. See if we can't get the economy going, drop rates even more, drop them to zero. Now, we do happen to be, I think, the only central bank that hasn't tried negative rates.
Never went negative, that's right. Yeah.
The marketplace has taken rates negative, but the Fed has not. They've said, no, zero is about as much as we can stand and probably get reappointed to our positions at the Federal Reserve Board with these cushy jobs. So what happened recently is that when the Fed finally threw in the towel and said, well, sometime during this decade, we think we will start raising rates. And the market panicked. Rates start rising. That's bad for bonds. For all those of you who have a balanced portfolio, you have a big commitment to bonds. And rates rising sounds like good because the bank will pay you more money for your cash. But bonds get hurt in a rising rate environment. So as the fear of the Fed hiking rates sometime a couple of years from now set in. And rates started to rise. Bonds start, particularly long-dated bonds, started to crash. Hedge funds who were betting on bonds going the opposite direction had to cover their bets. And when they run out of money covering bets going against them, they have to start selling stocks. So the recent week worth of stock selling wasn't driven so much by bad economic news. In fact, if interest rates are rising because the economy is getting stronger, that should be good news.
That sounds positive, but that's not always the effect it has on the market, which is one of the problems with forecasting. Even if you knew what the news was going to be, you don't know how that's going to affect the market. And that's the only part of it that will do you any good.
Well, that's certainly true. And we don't forecast. We have absolutely no idea what's going to happen on Monday when the market opens up. Now, as far as general health of the market and health of sectors are concerned, we pay attention to what's going on right now. What is attracting investor capital? We call it magnets for money, because this is a global market, so it doesn't matter as much what you and I, individual investors here in the United States of America, God's greatest country in all creation, it doesn't matter what we think. We have a global community of people looking at U.S. markets, and collectively, it is Who Wants to Be a Millionaire story. Remember that show? If you were stumped, you had three choices, one of which was to poll the audience. And as the show aged, they could figure out which was the most correct or the most probably correct answer. And it always came from the audience. It wasn't the specialist that you knew. It wasn't the friend you wanted to call. It was polling the audience. The collective wisdom was right more often than the other choices. And that's basically what the stock market is. It is reflecting, maybe it's not always the wisdom, but it's certainly the opinion, the collective opinion of global investors, that is attracting money to certain sectors and to individual stocks. So we pay attention to what's the magnet for money in the current market. What happened in the 60s and 70s? If you're not our client, that's built into your portfolio, because apparently what happened in the 60s and the 70s and the 30s is really important information today. I mean, they don't even teach it in school anymore. It's called history, and they're kind of getting rid of that. But if you take a look at what's really going on right now, the last 3, 4, 5 weeks, last quarter, and you're paying attention to magnets for money, you're going to know what the collective global opinion is about a potential stock investment.
And what's going on in the market's the only thing that's important. It doesn't matter how many great stories you're hearing. It doesn't matter how many great narratives are being formed about what's coming up and why the market's moving the way it's moving. None of that stuff matters. It never does. It's only the price. Where's the price going? What's happening in the market for real instead of what someone else is predicting? And so it's your money ahead all the time if you can just ignore it. Just ignore the talking heads. Sometimes it's interesting, but we always say it may be interesting, but it's almost never actionable. You can't take action based on what anyone predicts of the future or how compelling a story they tell about, well, this is what has to happen coming up. It's not. You have to wait and see what actually unfolds to decide where things need to go. And that's when you follow the money. That's when you look for where that cash is going. And you can follow it into the market. You can also follow it out if everybody's leaving. But you don't base anything on what somebody says they believe is coming up. They're just far too inaccurate.
So one of the institutions that investors often look to and we often reference for the opinion about their forecast is the Federal Reserve. Chairman Jay Powell presently, and their forecast accuracy is not very good.
It really isn't. And their follow-through on, well, here's what we're going to be doing. Nope, usually things don't work out the way the Fed thinks they are. Things are going to. And if the Fed, with all the information they have available and all the PhDs and Nobel Prize winners they have working for them, and they can't get it right, then I'm not sure anybody sitting in a CNBC studio is going to have any better opinion either.
Well, and Perry, you just made a phenomenal point about the amount of data that the Fed has. And they have massive amounts of data. But the one thing you said prior to that was the only thing that really matters is price. Because we can argue about all sorts of things. We can argue that a price is too high or too low. But the price is what it is. Mm-hmm. And if you chain those prices together day after day after day, you can plot them on a chart, and guess what? You get a trend line.
Hey, that's a good idea, Don. We should do that.
We should try that.
It's exactly what we do. So, we watch those trends. You can watch them build. You can watch them crumble. Something that's been in an uptrend will just slowly turn over, and you can just watch it disappear. And that's when you need to take action. That's what doesn't happen if you've got that pie chart portfolio. You've got that thing, it's been laid out there, and it's not going to change regardless of what goes on in the market. And we think that's very dangerous because the market changes so much now, and it changes so quickly that you have to be able to adapt to what's going on out there. And it changes in ways that no one's ever seen before. So it can't be accounted for in a static pie chart. No one can account for some of the things that are coming up because no one knows what they are, of course. And so paying attention to what's going on currently and then adapting the portfolio to current market conditions, that's where you can actually build some safety into a portfolio.
So the standard market structure and portfolio structure is the older you get, the more bonds you should own.
Correct. Yes.
Ignoring the fact that we are at virtually zero interest rates and that virtually everybody believes that interest rates will go higher, which means virtually everybody believes but does not understand that their bond portfolio has very high risk associated with it. But the older I get, the more I'm told I'm supposed to buy bonds, an asset which has an increasing probability of losing money for me as interest rates rise with a growing economy, assuming it does grow, if we have another $6 trillion of federal debt on projects that may or may not actually exist. But be that as it may, what you should have, the way we operate, is you should look at the stock market risk management in the same way that you analyze, let's say, a football game. Most of the action on a football game occurs between the 30-yard lines. It's up, it's down, it's back, it's forth. Somebody's got the ball. No, the other team has the ball. So it's kind of, well, it looks like stocks. No, it looks like bonds. This is a back and forth trying to get a positive, affirmative direction to it until somebody throws a long Hail Mary pass, it gets caught. And on one end of the football field, you have a goalpost, which we call stocks. And on the other end of the field, we have a goalpost, which we call cash. And in the middle, you have all kinds of stocks and bonds. And they rotate back and forth. And every now and then, you end up at either the all-stock portfolio, because that's where the game is. And other times, things are going against you, and you end up on the other goalpost where it's all cash because there's nothing that makes any sense in the market from a risk management standpoint. And that's the way we manage accounts. We move between those two goalposts based on our regular risk-on, risk-off review every week. Should we be in? Should we be partially in? Should we be out? And that's why in October of 18, as the market crashed 20% in those last 3 months of the year, we were in cash. Not because we had a crystal ball that worked, but because market-generated data said, this isn't working. And if it's not working, I'm not going to keep driving my car through the flood. We're going to stop until the water subsides, and the road is dry, and then we'll re-enter, which is exactly what we did in the first part of 19. And that's the same thing that we did last year when the market tanked in February and March. I mean, all of our models, whether they were our direct client models or our 401k models, they all ended up in cash prior to the damage of the market last year, dropping S&P, dropping 34%. Sell high so you have cash to buy at market lows. That is a disciplined risk managed evaluation that brings better safety, sleep, and gains.
And we didn't have to predict that. We didn't make that prediction. We watched what was going on in the market, and that's where the market actually led us. We followed the money and said, it's time to go. And it happens time and time again. It's a repeatable process. And that's real protection. That'll really protect your portfolio, not just taking the big loss and saying, well, let's wait 30 years for this to come back. That is not protecting your portfolio. That's just waiting on the market and doing nothing. And that's just not good enough, especially if you're in retirement. We are at the bottom of the hour here. Time to get out of here for our second break of the day. I'd like to remind you that if you're not getting our Week in Review, which is our weekly email newsletter, goes out most Mondays, you can sign up for that by sending us an email. Just send an email to help@irradio.com. That is help@irradio.com. Put Week in Review in the subject line, and then we just need your first and last name in the body of the email. We'll get you signed up, and you will begin receiving that this Monday. You are listening to Investor Resources here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden along with the sunshine. There's got to be a little rain.
Well, we know about rain in the Northwest. We were talking about forecasting in the market. And there are specialized, let's call them soothsayers, for virtually everything. You have gold bugs. There's lots of ads for gold on television. I kill the sound when they're running.
you already know that, right? You've heard this before. Heard it. Yeah.
There are inflationistas, doomsayers, the world is coming to an end. There are permabulls. Don't worry about the market being down for 6 years in a row. It's not a problem. The economy is great. The United States is always going to win. And you just hang on to those losing stocks, and someday they are going to be winners once again. That's the buy and hold. We do your asset allocation because that's the most important part of earning your wealth, which is a lie. But let me come back to that. There are niche forecasters about all sorts of things on the future. If you pay attention long enough, you realize they repeat the same thing year after year. It's like a broken record.
The song never changes. It's just the same verse over and over and over. They just never stop. And people buy into it. The better the story, the more attention they're going to get. The more eyes on the screen, the more readers on their newsletter, and people begin to buy in. You start to get convinced. Hey, you know what? They could be right because they tell a great story to go along with the data that they're looking at. But that story usually has almost nothing to do with reality, unfortunately.
So the reality is that market forecasters have a long tradition of being wrong. The only difference between your local fortune teller or tarot card reader and the market forecaster is one gets dressed up to go on CNBC. But the accuracy of both of them generally is more tied to luck. I just mentioned in passing a moment ago, this is a rabbit trail, Perry, but it's relevant. Which is an exceptional in itself, right?
Sure, yeah.
and that is the mantra in the financial industry is that asset allocation is the primary determinant of your future returns. And that is a lie. It is financial abuse. Harry Markowitz, who published a paper in 1952, just prior to Studebaker going bankrupt and out of business, His theory about what is now called modern portfolio theory never said asset allocation was the primary determinant of your future returns. He did say, did write in his Nobel Prize work, that asset allocation is the primary determinant of the volatility in your portfolio. But volatility in and of itself has nothing to do with your returns. But it sounds so much better if we just twist it a little bit and substitute volatility for your investment success. And it was brought to my attention this last week because an individual brought into me his preliminary proposal from Fisher Investments. And Fisher spends hundreds of millions a year on marketing. I mean, you hear him on the radio, you see him on TV, and you get one of these extremely heavy paper, nicely printed proposals, and you have to say, this is impressive. But when you read it, if you understand what they've done in the proposal, is they've just gone back to some easy sales tactics, because the funnel effect of asset allocation determines your investment success is not an accurate representation of what the study they're referring to actually states. It's financial manipulation of data to help sell something.
And Markowitz also made it very clear in 1952 when he published his paper that there was absolutely no predictive value in what he was doing. There was nothing saying this is what the future is going to hold. In fact, you have to not care what the future is going to hold to implement that strategy. So there's nothing in there that says, well, your asset allocation is going to predict your returns. He said the opposite. This has no predictive value at all. There's nothing here. He always thought they would figure it out, that they would find the predictive side of his modern portfolio theory. But it never happened. It never got there. And it's not surprising, because that's trying to see the future, and it's not going to be there. And so it didn't pan out that way, but it's still marketed that way today.
So that's where we keep referring to the pie charts, because most people have a proposal for an asset allocation model that they follow, because you answered some risk questions. How much money do you have? When are you going to retire? When do you need to take money out? Do you need to take it out monthly or quarterly? Do you have a college education coming up? You're going to buy a new car, a new home, a second home. You're going to bail out your irresponsible kids because you hate to see them suffer. Whatever these things are, and how do you personally feel about losing money? What would you do?
There's always those questions about how much money are you willing to lose? Because the idea is we want to find out what your pain threshold is, and then we're going to deliver that much pain. So it's not to protect you from anything. It's just to find out how much can we get away with you?
So what's the purpose of all that? There is a single purpose, and it is not to figure out how to build your portfolio to be profitable. It is to be prepared that when things don't work out the way you think they should, and you find an attorney who agrees with you, which is not hard, that's how they're, because you answered those questions that way, and they followed Harry Markowitz and subsequent academic studies about, well, we think this might work. That's how they're going to defend themselves in court, because you told them through your answers to their questions how to structure your portfolio. Had absolutely nothing to do with what is actually going on in the market. It has everything to do with, over the last 80 years, things have worked in such and such a manner, and you live another 80 or 90 years, and it might happen again.
Maybe.
And if that's your comfort level and you can sleep on that, then whatever happens, good or bad, like the tech bubble crashing 90% in 2.5 years, or the S&P down 50% and taking 7 years to get even, if that's your comfort level, then we do wish you well and glad you're able to sleep through that. Frankly, we've been through it, and our clients have been through it. And we said, no more. We are not going to do that again. We cannot afford at this stage of life to be willing to just arbitrarily lose 30, 40, 50% of our portfolio and say, it doesn't matter. It will come back someday. And I can just wait to use my money. I don't need to worry about losses of that sort. Because the U.S. is a strong country, and it is, and the market will come back, and it will. It's just, will it come back in my time frame?
And that's the part they always leave out. They always leave out the part about, well, if everything is going down together, which is what happens when we have a large drawdown, everything I own is going to go down too. And at that point, we're going to do nothing. We're just going to let it drop, and we don't know how far it's going to drop, and we don't know how long it's going to stay down, but we're still not going to change anything. And they never say those words out loud. They always couch it in, you know, you're in here for the long term, and we're going to hold through this because we're long-term investors. But they never get to the part about, well, if the market's down 50%, so are you. And it's going to come back whenever it comes back. We have no idea when that might be. Your money's just going to be gone until it does. And that's the way it's supposed to work. That's the way the process operates. They just never actually tell you that.
Well, after all, they're professional institutional money managers. Therein lies your problem. They are institutional, which means they expect to hang on to your money forever. They do not have a plan to liquidate it. That is up to you. And if you need your money at a market low, that's not their problem because they're in there for the long haul. John Templeton, at his annual stockholder meetings, always got somebody who was complaining about some stock that he had bought in the portfolio because it was sucking wind. It was not doing anything. And there's always, and he had a big stockholder meeting. It's kind of like Warren Buffett's stock, Berkshire Hathaway stock name, and thousands of people show up. But Sir Templeton would look them in the eye and get right up in the microphone and say, it doesn't matter. In 10 years, I'll be proven right. Okay. In 10 years, you might break even with your money in a standard pie chart portfolio. And all you need is one massive correction to undo a decade of decent gains. But where we are in terms of corporate profits and stock prices today suggest that the average returns that people are expecting from the average financial advisor proposal aren't going to happen. We don't know that, but statistically, that's what the odds are. And just think about bonds. You have a bond portfolio allocation, 40%, maybe it's as much as 50%. If you're older, it could be 60%. And that bond assumption is you're going to earn about 5.5% a year. Now, consider junk bonds. Now, what are junk bonds? Well, junk bonds are from companies that people aren't sure how they're going to stay out of bankruptcy. And if they go into bankruptcy, you don't get your money back. Those junk bonds are paying less than 4%. That's the high risk. That's the highest risk end of the market. And yet your portfolio is built on a 5.5% assumption, which means interest rates are going to get lower than they are now over the next 30 years. Are you comfortable with that assumption?
Because that's baked in. Yeah, that's baked in. That's what people believe is going to happen. If you're thinking about those returns being the same in the future as they were for the past 30 years, but it's not going to happen that way. It just can't from where we are. The math just doesn't work out. But the math says we're up for our last break of the morning. We have plenty of time. We have a whole segment to get your calls on the board. If you'd like to give us a call, 888-312-5757. Also like to remind you that on Saturday, July 10th, 9:15, we're going to have our next market update. You can register for that by going to iriradio.com. That is iriradio.com. Stay with us. We will be right back.
Hey, well, all right, sir, here we go there, and what are they going to give for? I've a $600 down here, now 10 and now 25 and now 35 and now 50 and now 60. Will they give me 60 now, 75, 75, another $85 on the bottom there?
Well, we're up in our last segment here. We haven't promoted the phone number a lot, but here's the last chance to do that. 888-312-5757. 888-312-5757. We've got about a little less than 10 minutes before we are going to be replaced with another program. But be that as it may, remember that we mentioned earlier, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire show. How about Who Wants to Be a Property Owner, a Landlord? Well, I think there are an awful lot of smaller landlords who are saying, why would you, given the abuse that we've taken from various government agencies? However, hope springs eternal somewhere, and the Blackstone Group, which capitalized on the mortgage fraud problem and all the collapsing real estate of a decade ago, turned around and sold all that property and a big gain. They are back in the business of scooping up tens of thousands of single-family homes. However, there's been a little misrepresentation of that. They have not been going out and taking advantage of Ma and Pa Kettle, who are down on their finances and say, well, you know, we can close this deal right now. If you just, you know, you sign over the title here and here's your money, you go. Go find someplace else to live if you can.
Good luck. Right.
Blackstone actually did is they bought up a couple of companies that are in the rental business where they own thousands of single-family homes for rent. There are companies that is their business. And Blackstone decided that that's an opportunity to be in again. So they got a lot of press. They are now the proud owners of a whole bunch of single-family homes that were owned by real estate investment trusts. And that's a legitimate business, and it's actually doing fairly well. Millennials, well, it's doing fairly well, particularly since the pandemic showed up and people said, I don't think I want to live crammed into a cracker box with a whole bunch of other cracker boxes right next to me. Let's find our little bit of green space, the old Green Acres story.
There we go. People are moving out, getting a little more into suburbia and looking for a little more space. And, there's finally millennials have been pushing back, you know, getting married, having kids. And now that that's happening, it's like, oh, yeah, that's why you need that house. That's why you need that backyard. And that's all coming around. It's just been delayed.
So this basically comes down to demographics. And demographics drive the economy. Sometimes they drive it fast, and sometimes demographics drives it slow. And the baby boomers after World War II was a massive, that's what they call it, boom, rate of birth. That meant that the system wasn't prepared for kids entering kindergarten, and surprisingly, they weren't prepared for kids entering first grade at these massive numbers, which begs the question, by the time they got to college, don't you think colleges should have figured out that this massive enrollment was headed their way?
They had a fair bit of lead time and still weren't very prepared. So
not at all.
Everybody watches that much more closely now.
So here we are with housing, and housing has kind of had a lull. The X-Gen, being a smaller demographic, didn't put that much demand on society for anything. And here we are with the millennials now, and as you just said, Perry, they get into their jobs, they're getting married later, and they had kids a little later, and pretty soon that little toddler needs a little more space than running around the kitchen. So the house looks pretty attractive, and that is what is happening today. And this is a demographic trend that is going to last probably for a couple of decades.
There's lots of people in that age cohort. The 30-year-olds are a huge group right now, and that's basically when people really begin heading out there and trying to find a piece of real estate to live in instead of just someplace to sleep in. And that's when the home buying occurs. And that's what's going on now. And it's going to take a while to run through them all, because right now, of course, we have a new home shortage. So we've got that imbalance out there. There's too many people looking for too few homes, and supply and demand always wins. And that's why prices are going up still.
Well, and whether or not that supply will work its way out, but right now it's a little tenuous because until just the last 6 weeks, lumber prices were at exorbitant levels. They were almost $1,100 per thousand board feet. They have dropped back a bit, but they're still high enough to cause builders some angst about entering into new construction projects. And associated metals required in construction, copper and steel, those prices haven't dropped that much. So there's a big backlog and reluctance on contractors to enter. And the assumption that people would, at these prices, would willingly sell their home has not panned out the way you would normally expect, because potential sellers are telling their brokers, hey, I'm willing to sell. I mean, if you can get me that much money for my house, that I've never seen that much money in my life, I'd be glad to take it. But before I do, you find me a home to buy, because I don't want to end up on the street. I don't want to end up in a hotel trying to find some place to keep from being on the street.
And that's easy. It's easy to find a place. It just won't be here. If you're in Western Washington, it's going to be somewhere else, because everything here is already left. The arena of the reasonable priced home is not here anymore. So you're going to have to be willing to sell here and then relocate somewhere else to make that work. That's the problem.
So this demand group, the millennials, have been in their 30s, 30 to 39. There are now 4.5 million more of them than there were just 10 years ago. Strange thing happens as time passes. People get older. It just happens. So we have more and more of these that are coming online. The other assumption was that boomers would be selling their homes as they moved into retirement communities or nursing homes. However, the advent of modern medicine has extended the life of boomers beyond the age that they were supposed to live, which is a problem for Medicare, Social Security, and now housing supply, because they're staying in their houses longer. They're healthier. They can do things that in prior generations were never thought possible, to be living this long, as healthy, as active, playing pickleball in their near 70s. I mean, who'd have thunk it? But that's going on, and that's reducing supply. So price trends, the trend will probably continue for some time. If you're thinking of waiting for the next housing crash to buy your first home, you might spend some time evaluating the assumptions around that. We think demand is going to be quite strong, and it would take some exogenous event to actually disrupt that and really create a massive housing price collapse. But that's positive if you're thinking of selling something. It's just, sure, what are you going to buy to live in once you sell? I mean, Linda and I have been dealing with this question for several years.
Sure.
Which is, well, we really like our house.
And that's part of what's going to be coming up. The boomers eventually are going to either have to move into senior housing, or they're just going to want to downsize. And all of those homes are going to come on the market eventually, but it's not going to be in a huge, single wave. That's going to take time, which is why, like you just said, Don, if you're waiting to buy on the dip in the housing market, that could be a long wait.
So we have to pay attention to demographics, and we have for the last couple of decades ourselves. It's just that demographics are not a timing issue. They're a macro trend issue. We did have some positive news on the Microsoft side. They became one of the $2 trillion club members.
How about that?
There aren't very many of them, but their shares rose more than 2% in New York trading on Tuesday, which means Microsoft and Apple are the only two members of the $2 trillion club. I mean, On the 10th, we are doing our, delayed, but we are doing our stock market update webinar. To register for that at iriradio.com. That's iriradio.com. You want to talk to us during the week, 800-317-9119. That's 800-317-9119. The Monday's Week in Review will go out on Monday. If you don't get it, send us an email, help@iriradio.com. Week in Review in the subject line, first and last name in the body of the letter. And Lord willing, we'll be back next week.